So our next presenter will be talking about sleep disorders in neurodegenerative disorders. Her name is Dr. Lucy Carrier. She is a clinical psychologist specializing in health psychology. She completed her graduate training at Auburn University, an internship through Vanderbilt University and the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee, and a fellowship at the Cleveland Clinic's Mellon Center for Multiple Sclerosis. Prior to joining the LuRuvo Center for Brain Health, she worked in geriatric primary care and provided psychotherapy for individuals and caregivers living with neurodegenerative disorders and complex medical conditions. She's interested in outcomes research related to caregivers. And please welcome Dr. Carrier.
Thank you, Leanne, for the introduction. I'm Dr. Lucille Carrier, and I'm going to speak with you today about sleep disorders and neurodegenerative diseases. In speaking about neurodegenerative diseases and sleep disturbances, it's first important to recognize sleep in older adults, particularly sleep as it changes as we age. Irrespective of medical comorbidities and medications, sleep parameters in general change with age. Nocturnal sleep duration, efficiency, and even deep sleep generally decrease over time, particularly from the ages of 20 to 60. However, number of nighttime awakenings, length of awakenings, as well as daytime napping tend to increase over time. Circadian rhythms also become less robust with aging and typically manifest in advanced circadian timing. Sleepiness also tends to occur in the evening with wake-ups earlier than desired in populations as you get older. Also, too, we see a decrease in melatonin secretion over time. Generally speaking, poor sleep quality, sleep disturbances are not always due to age-related changes. Developmental processes such as lifestyle, as well as medical comorbidities, are likely to contribute. Interestingly, most of the changes that we've just discussed with regard to sleep parameters tend to stop at approximately 60 years of age. After that, most sleep parameters tend to remain largely unchanged after the age of 60 within healthy older adults. However, in the context of medical comorbidities, in particular neurodegenerative diseases, we see exacerbations of age-related sleep disturbances. When we think about the impact of neurodegenerative diseases on sleep, we often think about various factors. We know that these are prevalent within neurodegenerative diseases, sleep dysfunction that is, and there's increasing evidence that points to the role of disease pathology as a contributor to sleep dysfunction, particularly deterioration of sleep-controlling centers in the brain. We also see disease symptoms as a significant contributor to sleep dysfunction, particularly as we think about motor dysfunction, tremors, spasticity, urological issues, as well as chronic pain. Thirdly, we think about the medications used to treat these disorders. Levodopa therapy, corticosteroids, as well as other medications can also be direct contributors to sleep pathology in our populations. When we think about the impact of poor sleep on neurodegenerative disease populations, it can be rather significant. We know that it's associated with a reduced quality of life, increased mood symptoms, which also may reduce functional status, independence in activities, daytime sleepiness and fatigue are often reported. We also see manifestations in cognitive functioning, particularly a worsening. In addition, it's been associated with accelerated disease progression, as well as increased caregiver burden. In fact, sleep disturbances are often regarded as one of the top reasons for institutionalization of neurodegenerative disease populations. Now let's talk a little bit about common sleep disorders within neurodegenerative diseases. Sleep disturbances in Parkinson's disease can be incredibly common. In fact, it's one of the most frequent non-motor Parkinson's symptoms reported. Community samples indicate specifically that sleep-wake disturbances, fragmented sleep, early morning awakenings in particular, are frequently reported. We know that insomnia in general is reported in upwards of 70% of those living with Parkinson's disease. We know that motor symptoms, slowness in movement, rigidity, tremors, nocturia, as well as pain can be significant contributors to nighttime sleep for those living with Parkinson's, as well as depression and anxiety. We also see hypersomnia within Parkinson's patients. Upwards of 50% will report difficulties specifically with excessive daytime sleepiness, which may also have a relationship to their levodopa therapy. Also, we see an increased rates of movement-related sleep disorders within Parkinson's. Specifically, we see restless legs, upwards of 20% of individuals living with Parkinson's, as well as periodic limb movements, which can increase fragmentation during the night. Parasomnias are also reported at a higher rate. Specifically, REM sleep behavior disorder is a well-known associate of Parkinson's disorder, again contributing to fragmentation. Upwards of 60% will report this. And also, too, has potential for injury, not only for the patient, but also, too, for the care partner or the bed partner. And thinking about sleep disorders and Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, we specifically start looking at insomnia. Nearly 25 to 45% of those living with Alzheimer's will report, or their caregivers will report, fragmented sleep, daytime fatigue, and even daytime napping and excessive sleepiness. We know that sleep disturbances typically occur early in the disease and generally worsen as the disease progresses, with particular intensification in the later stages of the disease. Fragmented, irregular sleep patterns may also present, particularly with irregular sleep patterns and more shifts in circadian rhythm disorders. Additionally, breathing-related sleep disorders are also common within Alzheimer's. Upwards of 40 to 70% will report this, which can lead to fragmented sleep, as well as daytime sleepiness, fatigue, and general disinhibition and withdrawal from daily activities. Within multiple sclerosis, prevalence rates are kind of mixed as it relates to specifically thinking about breathing-related sleep disorders, particularly obstructive sleep apnea, but insomnia can also be quite prevalent. Upwards of 50% of the population will report difficulties with either initiating or maintaining sleep, spasticity, bladder issues, as well as depression and anxiety can be primary contributors to overall sleep quality within MS. Additionally, restless leg syndrome can also be more prevalent within MS. Upwards of 10 to 15% will report that, which can lead to, again, fragmentation, delayed sleep, and general decreases in daytime functioning. Broadly speaking, when we think about sleep disorders, particularly those that warrant an increased rate of frequency of symptoms and have a daytime impact on overall functioning for individuals, we recognize that they are generally unreported, underreported, underdiagnosed, as well as undertreated. And so certainly this raises a lot of concerns as we think about comprehensive neurological care for our neurodegenerative disease populations and thinking about the recognition that sleep plays in overall clinical care. As we transition, I'd like for us to talk about how we can screen, how we can think about assessment, a much needed area when we think about recognition of these sleep disturbances. We want to think about, first and foremost, how we inquire about this at medical visits. Are we asking enough? Are we asking routinely at every visit? This is crucial in the identification of potential exacerbating factors that could be also contributing to those sleep dysfunctions. Ideally, investigation of sleep complaints should be incorporated into a full review of systems. We really want to think about the nature of the sleep disturbances. Is it defined by difficulty falling asleep? Is it defined by fragmentation of sleep or early morning awakening? That can provide some diagnostic clues as to where to investigate next. Also, too, we want to think about nocturnal manifestations of neurological symptoms and how those might be interfering with sleep. How are tremors, rigidity, spasticity, dyskinesia, urinary disruptions? What does that look like, say, in the evening hours? Or once you have gotten to sleep, what does that look like? So these are things we want to think about from the perspective of the medical provider and really starting to investigate those sleep disturbances. Here's some sample questions to kind of think about how we start to gain an understanding of the nature of those sleep disturbances. Some of these items are more reflective of insomnia, But certainly we know with sleep latency, sleep fragmentation being problematic and quite common in these populations might be a really nice place to start. Specifically starting to think about the timing of sleep. You know, what time are you getting into bed? How many hours are you sleeping on night at night, do you think? Do you have any trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, for example? And really starting to kind of follow that and using a bit of a diagnostic tree to understand the nature of those sleep disturbances. Also thinking about the daytime impact. What is that looking like? Is it bothersome to you as the patient? Is it bothersome to the caregiver, to the bed partner? What are they observing? Also, too, it's important to really spend time understanding the patient's definition of sleepiness. Oftentimes, this is used interchangeably with fatigue terminology and can be really critical, again, in thinking about diagnostic clarity. Understanding, again, is this sleepiness? Is this looking at fatigue? And understanding, again, in the context of those neurological symptoms. Also, too, in that investigative phase, we also, too, want to think about the caregiver as well as the bed partner observations. They can be particularly powerful in shedding light on sleep-wake patterns of the patient, as well as nocturnal observations of things that the patient may not be able to report on, specifically breathing-related sleep symptoms, or even those movement-related or parainsomnias can be really helpful in terms of diagnostic clarity. In addition, atigraphy can also be a beneficial tool for a clinician, which atigraphy is a device that's worn on the wrist. It records movements that can be used to estimate various sleep parameters, and it uses a specialized algorithm to understand that specific data. And so, again, this can be helpful. It's well-validated within the estimation of general sleep patterns across various age groups, and in particular within dementia populations. And this can be particularly useful if you have the presence of, like I said, those cognitive deficits where inquiring about sleep patterns may be challenging with a particular patient. It's also important, too, to incorporate brief patient screening questionnaires into clinical practice. Again, in a busy practice, you may not have time to kind of to conduct a full sleep evaluation. So having the data from these relatively brief questionnaires can be quite helpful. Some of these have been validated within neurodegenerative disease populations, but unfortunately, not all. And that's one of the challenges, and again, in assessing within neurodegenerative disease populations. But really kind of thinking about a breadth in terms of that assessment. Thinking about, am I assessing for insomnia? Do I have a scale to assess for breathing-related sleep disorder? Do I have a scale in there specifically for daytime sleepiness, fatigue? Again, common symptoms that we would encounter in a neurodegenerative disease population. Again, though, some of these are going to be limited in the presence of cognitive dysfunction, so it's important to also have the care partner assist in filling those out, or perhaps they fill those out, and you have a discussion about it. These alone should not be used in isolation to make diagnoses, and in fact, should be one part of a comprehensive evaluation. All right, so let's transition a little bit now thinking about management options for these sleep disturbances. First and foremost, we want to think about management of medical conditions. Specifically, are current medical conditions or symptoms, independent of sleep, are those being optimally managed at this time? The neurodegenerative disease that you may be treating, as well as any other comorbid conditions. Thinking also, are medication adjustments needed? Again, are those being optimal? Are those optimal at this time? Also, too, I think it's important to have a consideration of a referral to a specialty medicine provider for further workup, evaluation of particular conditions that may be interfering with sleep. Pain and neurological conditions specifically are quite common. In addition, are we starting to think, too, about non-pharmacological interventions, thinking about would occupational therapy, physical therapy be helpful in the treatment of, say, spasticity or postural instability that may be affecting sleep at night. Also, too, we want to think about sleep hygiene. So you may be thinking, well, what about sleep hygiene? Could I provide some of that education as I start to think about sleep fragmentation and insomnia specifically? Before we answer that, it's important to also recognize, what is sleep hygiene? We use it often and we use it interchangeably. Specifically, this focuses on lifestyle environmental factors that could be interfering with sleep, as well as a little bit of sleep education. Unfortunately, though, what we know is that sleep hygiene is not an effective standalone treatment for insomnia disorder. And in fact, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine has recommended against its use as a single treatment, as a single component treatment for chronic insomnia. Although sleep recommendations, sleep hygiene recommendations are necessary and can be part of a multi-component treatment, they're insufficient in the treatment of insomnia disorder. And oftentimes, exclusively focusing in the clinic on how to improve sleep, how to make sure your meal times are at a earlier time, that you're not exercising, that you're watching, say your substance intake, for example, can delay initiation of more effective behavioral sleep treatments. All right, so to prescribe or not, what about the role of sleep-promoting medications? Evidence suggests actually modest improvements in sleep latency and sleep duration with the use of medications. And there's even more limited evidence as it pertains specifically to Parkinson's, MS, and even dementia populations. Unfortunately, benefits that do come with medications short-term will dissipate following discontinuation of those medications. So it really does come to a consideration of a risk-benefit ratio, particularly for these populations, thinking about issues related to dependency, cognitive impairment, which we know we're going to be at a higher risk with these populations, their increased risk for falls and injuries, as well as daytime sedation. Ultimately, this is a collaborative decision-making process that needs to happen between patient and provider, thinking about preferences, values, as well as do they have access to non-pharmacological means. We also want to think about specifically the role that sleep medications can play in moderate to severe dementia. Generally, there is a lack of empirical evidence regarding the use and prescribing guidelines for this population, especially in considering other dementia subtypes. We also, too, want to think about the role of behavioral strategies, which tend to be first line for these populations. And of course, there's going to be a risk-benefit ratio. Oftentimes, medications may be more helpful that help promote sleep in the context of managing, say, behavioral or psychiatric disturbances. And again, this is going to be a collaborative decision-making process between the caregiver, the patient, as they can participate, and that provider. All right, so let's consider a referral to sleep medicine. This may also be part of your approach as a medical provider in terms of how to manage these sleep disruptions. Oftentimes when these primary sleep disorders are present or you've screened for them and there appear to be symptoms consistent with these disorders, they may require specialized evaluation and or treatment, specifically thinking about breathing-related sleep disorders that will require an overnight sleep study, thinking about movement-related sleep disorders as well, that are going to, again, require an overnight sleep study for diagnostic confirmation, as well as pharmacological management. Hypersomnolence disorders can also can oftentimes be better treated within a sleep medicine clinic because you may need the overnight sleep study for confirmation. There may be other sleep studies that could be helpful for diagnosis, as well as pharmacological management. And lastly, circadian rhythm disorders, sleep disorders, can also be treated best in sleep medicine clinics because of the need for specialized and tailored behavioral treatments. There may also be instances in which chronic insomnia disorder may benefit from a referral to sleep medicine in order to seek and receive specialized behavioral treatment. There may be patients that maybe medications have been initiated, but minimal benefit has been reported. Those would also be appropriate referrals to sleep medicine. Patients reporting persistent sleep difficulties despite treatment optimization of their neurodegenerative disease population, or excuse me, disease, may also benefit from referral to sleep medicine. And lastly, thinking about medically complex patients, those with a number of medical comorbidities in addition to their neurodegenerative disease could benefit from a workup with a sleep medicine specialist. All right, now a referral to behavioral sleep medicine. So what is behavioral sleep medicine? So that is focused, it's a subset of sleep psychology that is focused on the evaluation and treatment of sleep disorders, really aiming to target behavioral, psychological, as well as physiological factors that interfere with sleep. These providers can be exceptional in their clinical expertise in tailoring well-known and evidence-based treatments in these disease populations. A behavioral sleep medicine evaluation is quite comprehensive. It involves examining the nature, the history of sleep problems, as well as what's the daytime impact, a comprehensive review of health behaviors, looking at bedtime routine, really examining other behavioral factors that could be contributing, a thorough evaluation of their medication history, screening for other sleep-related disorders, as well as environmental factors. And so taken all, this is what really kind of gives us as a behavioral sleep provider a really comprehensive look at what could be the factors affecting this and taking into consideration the neurodegenerative disease. When we think about insomnia specifically, one of the most prevalent conditions when in neurodegenerative disease populations, we look at first-line treatment, which includes cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And the American Academy of Sleep Medicine has recommended strongly for its use in the treatment of insomnia disorder. Cognitive behavioral therapy involves the use of stimulus control, really working on the association between the bed and sleepiness. It also utilizes sleep restriction, which enhances that natural homeostatic sleep drive that may be eroded within neurodegenerative diseases, and works to consolidate sleep by limiting time in bed. In addition, relaxation therapy is a critical part of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which involves structured exercises designed to reduce somatic tension, cognitive arousal that may perpetuate sleep problems. And lastly, cognitive therapy. So identifying and addressing myths and maladaptive thoughts that could be contributing to hyperarousal at bedtime. There's also other behavioral treatments that are applicable to neurodegenerative disease populations. Specifically thinking about that cognitive behavioral therapy. Within the neurodegenerative disease populations, the evidence is limited, although preliminary and early stage data has suggested that CBTI can be effective in neurodegenerative disease populations, we know that there's an element of tailoring that can be beneficial to the patient. Specifically thinking about the sleep education portion, understanding the impact of their specific neurodegenerative disease on sleep factors. Putting that into context, it helps with establishing and setting expectations for treatment outcomes, as well as understanding their disease. Also, too, the modified versions of CBTI take into effect the recommendations for behavioral treatments that may not work as well for neurodegenerative disease populations that have physical motor limitations, as well as cognitive impairments. So thinking about how we can tailor those for individuals that have difficulty moving in the bed or may have some cognitive deficits where repetition could be important. Also, too, taking into account often very complex medication dosing schedules, ones that often extend into the night, we want to take those into considerations as we think about sleep restriction, as we think about relaxation exercises. In addition, strategic napping can be helpful, particularly in populations where fatigue can be very prominent, as well as thinking about inclusion of the care partner in the treatment to help reinforce session content can be important. Also, too, various behavioral treatments can include cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. It can also include and extend to treatment of circadian rhythm disorders, the use of light box therapies to help with timing of sleep, Also, too, behavioral treatments can also encompass medications and working in collaboration with prescribers if patients are interested in, say, tapering off of sedative therapies. It's a behavior that's underlying, right? Medication adherence as well as wanting to taper off. So this is where behavioral treatments can be helpful in optimizing that treatment. Specifically thinking about behavioral treatments that are applicable for dementia, we know that there's good evidence that bright light therapy can be helpful for reducing fragmentation of sleep, afternoon agitation, and particularly in the context of irregular patterns of sleep and rest. Light can be one of the most powerful regulators in our circadian rhythm. And so thinking about physical activities, social activities with daytime routines can also be helpful in potentially regulating circadian rhythm and in cases when it may be disrupted. Really, we want to think about collaboration, education, even sleep education with care partners. In the context of working with more severe forms of cognitive dysfunction, it's going to be imperative that we have our caregivers involved in the process, understanding the rationale and able to provide consistency. That's really the key with these interventions, is consistency going to be something that we can ensure, and how can we better help support the care partners? And lastly, we want to think about the management of medical comorbidities, also to medication review. Are there medications that could be interfering with sleep or promoting sleep at inappropriate times? Again, all part of a comprehensive assessment in these particular populations. All right, here I have listed two websites specifically in terms of how to find a behavioral sleep medicine provider. You may not have one as part of your medical clinic and may not be aware of one in your geographic region. This can help point you in that direction, as well as help with starting the process of networking, particularly as you see these patients and recognize the value of having a multidisciplinary approach in this management. All right, in conclusion, sleep disturbances and neurodegenerative diseases are very common. Clinical assessment, continual monitoring of sleep should be part of comprehensive neurological care. We really want to prioritize sleep disturbances as well as the management of those to ensure quality of life for both the patient, the caregiver, as well as other aspects of health. Behavioral sleep intervention should also be considered as part of a multidisciplinary approach to management. All right, and I'm now ready for questions.
Hello. Thank you, Dr. Carrier. We appreciate all of that information. I'm going to sleep well tonight, I know that. Unfortunately, I think Dr. Carrier is having some technical problems, so we're going to have to answer your questions in the chat. So we are scheduled for a break. We're past scheduled for a break, so we're going to take that break, and we will be back at 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time. Be sure to visit our exhibitors. They are looking forward to your visit.